Hi, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
Today on Archive Fever, we're talking to Chloe Hooper, an award-winning Melbourne-based writer who's the author of two novels and two works of non-fiction. Her first novel, A Child's Book of True Crime, was shortlisted for the Orange Prize back in 2002, while her second book, The Tall Man, published in 2008, was a critically acclaimed investigation of an Aboriginal death in custody that won, I believe, no less than 10 literary prizes. More recently, Chloe's published a second novel in 2012 and has also spent many years working on a book about the Black Saturday fires that devastated Victoria in February 2009. That book, The Arsonist, was published in late 2018, and it's a deeply researched account of the deliberately lit fires in the Latrobe Valley, as well as the associated arson investigation. In the words of Robert Drew, The Arsonist is a fascinating real-life thriller, police procedural, intense sociological study, and the long-overdue story of fire in Australia. Chloe, welcome to Archive Fever, or Archives Anonymous, as we like to call it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Chloe, we'll get back to The Arsonist shortly, but I'd like to start by asking you if you can remember when you first got the research bug. When were you first bitten? Was it during the research for The Tall Man, or does it date back earlier?
I guess, you know, at university I liked the archives and Melbourne Uni had stacks that were, you know, mysterious and strange. Although I went and did graduate work in New York at Columbia University, and that library was really sort of second to none in terms of getting out of the lift and finding
yourself.
Archive
envy.
They were really sort of Hogwarts. And, you know, you never knew what you would find. Now, you know, so much of what you need is online. So there's not really quite the same for me sense of turning up in dusty places, although, you know, that happens. You can still get a little hit of that every now and then.
And what happens to you when you get that hit? What does archive fever look like for you?
Well, I don't know if I've got it as bad as you guys do.
We have it pretty bad.
It's yeah. True. I mean, I suppose it's just that you know, you sit in front of a document, and when it first appears, you imagine that it will be the answer to all your narrative problems. And then you start to read through and find that actually you might be lucky if you can haul away a couple of sentences. That can still be gold. I'm not like breaking into a sweat or anything, but if you were to put electrodes on my head, perhaps there would be sort of some flares or something.
Yeah, you're getting a few little sparks of joy and excitement.
Sure. Bit of dopamine action.
Yeah.
Turning to The Arsonist, I'm really curious about the process you used to investigate this story, especially since you only started researching it a few years after the events had taken place. What did that research process look like? How did you go about doing it?
Well, I suppose it was probably about 5 or 6 years after the fires that I finally got access to the police's brief of evidence. And that, of course, had, you know, an enormous amount of material in it. But I suppose it's not just archives. I feel like my main source of research is through people. So,
well, that's another sort of archive, maybe.
Well, you know, I guess you can be dealing with some institutions that are sort of a bit dusty, but no, I think it's really different, you know, dealing obviously with the people that you're writing about rather than sort of hidden in books. You know, so my work process is probably more about trying to, you know, win the trust of those who I'm going to be spending time interviewing. And then the archives and research is sort of second to that.
And how did you convince the police arson squad and the lawyers involved in this case to speak to you? I mean, it's obvious their testimony is some of the key sources you used. Yeah. What was that process like?
Well, I think with any project, you're kind of looking for a soft border to enter this new country. And I tried to contact various lawyers who'd represented Brendan Sokolock, the convicted arsonist at the centre of the story. And they weren't prepared to talk to me. And as a sort of last gambit, I rang the arson squad detective who'd arrested Brendan and been the conduit for victims' families throughout his very long legal process. And to my surprise, actually, he was interested in the idea of cooperating on a book. But it took a long time to get official permission from Victoria Police. And then I suppose that if, you know, one side is prepared to tell their story, then perhaps it's easier to convince, you know, the other side of the aisle to talk, and that eventually happened.
Yeah, because it's clear from the book that there was quite a bit of animosity between the defence lawyers and the police.
Yeah.
Was that difficult to navigate when you're sort of talking to both of them and trying to kind of perhaps empathise with their perspective?
Yes, that can be complicated. Mm. But then again, you know, they're also intrigued by what the other side has to say about them. So, you know, they had very different ideas of who Brendan was, and that was a complicated thing to try to knit together.
Chloe, you've mentioned before that any event that goes through the court system is a boon for the researcher because it creates a deep paper trail.
That's absolutely right.
It creates its own archive.
That's right.
But it's also a very particular kind of an archive. It's an archive that is in pursuit of wrongdoing and guilt and collecting evidence. And it goes through a kind of adversarial framework. So do you think that your pursuit of that particular archive, an adversarial court-based archive, shaped your thinking about the Black Saturday bushfires?
I'm not sure that it shaped my thinking about the bushfires, but you're right. I mean, it is a very particular archive. And it's interesting how from the police brief of evidence through a committal hearings, then to a trial, the information changes and the stories start to become more and more desiccated. And by the time the trial, you know, takes place, those giving evidence really are, you know, almost just giving their names and, you know, tiny snippets of what they've seen. So that's interesting just how the information's whittled down.
And it strikes me that it's an archive that's already created along kind of logical and predetermined lines. As you've just said, you've got this process and then that follows onto that process. Whereas often when we walk into an archive, it's just, you know, it's a mess. It's been sorted by an archivist in some kind of way, but it hasn't necessarily got a comprehensible form to it.
Yes.
Well, firstly, where is the archive even located? Where were you sitting when you were doing your research?
I was sitting in my office. You know, some things have fallen off the back of trucks, and you know that's always what you're sort of, you're looking for the right truck to pass by. And other things, you know, I'd applied to the courts and, you know, had transcripts of all of the hearings. And I must say that the amount of red tape in terms of actually getting access to some of this material, I understand that it's important, but I mean, there's one anecdote in that book which took place sort of 25 years earlier, and to apply for that through the coroner's court, to apply to get a coronial judgment which had been on the public record, you know, the actual paperwork involved and the sort of framing of sensitivities around doing that sort of sometimes does seem to me, you know, a bit too onerous.
So it also strikes me that if you're collecting these materials from various sources, you're almost collecting your own archive.
Yes.
So somebody else couldn't replicate the research that you've done.
No.
In the way that, say, an historian could go back to the same collection. So you've actually created your own collection.
Yes, yes. And it's sort of building up in tubs, and I can't now get to certain books, you know, in my office. So it is going to be time to, you know, move it to perhaps a library.
To archive your archive.
I'm going to archive my archive. That's very meta.
Then it raises the question, what do you call that archive? Is it the Chloe Hooper archive, or is it the Black Saturday archive, or is it the Arsonist archive?
Oh, look, I mean, they'll actually, if it does go and I can get to my shelves again, of course you have to, because I've already now started, you know, looking at something else. So I'm collecting material for that. But it will go with other research, you know, and research on the Western District for my last novel and on the Palm Island case for The Tall Man. But I'm talking about space rather than legacy here, you know, it's just...
But it is a legacy. It is a particular legacy of sorts. And I hadn't thought about this before, the way that the researcher actually creates a new collection that other researchers in the future can access themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it might be easier for them to get hold of certain things by my archive might not have such stringent rules attached to it. But let's see.
Which raises the question of the ethics of archiving.
With both your nonfiction books, you know, The Arsonist and The Tall Man, I mean, they both deal with very thorny ethical questions. We're dealing with crimes that resulted in death. There's court cases. Most of the people you're talking about are still alive. You know, for us who work in universities, we have the kind of luxury in a way of ethics committees to kind of help us navigate these questions and to kind of rubber stamp our processes. But you as a kind of more independent researcher would have, I imagine, had to go about this more independently. So how did you kind of navigate these ethical questions?
I suppose I really have to think about how I would feel. And yeah, I don't have an ethics committee to really, you know, visit on some of these issues. So I try to be very careful. I'm not sure how, you know, if I did have a board rubber stamping things, that it would be considerably different.
Were there any principles that kind of guided your decisions about the kind of information to include or not?
Oh, yes, particularly around some of the victim statements in The Arsonist. Obviously, that material is very distressing. And I had permission from one man whose story is there to use his statements to police. I also only approached people who had lost loved ones after the police had spoken to them and felt sure that they actually wanted to speak. I didn't, you know, cold call anyone or knock on their doors. I really tried to be as minimal with people's stories as I could be who I didn't know. There's some aggregation of material where, you know, sometimes I'll have just taken, you know, five words about a description of the fire as it was sort of rushing towards people. They're all nameless.
And did you show the manuscript to the people you interviewed, to the police?
Yes,
to the
I
lawyers?
Did. Yeah. Yes, I did. So they weren't surprised by the book.
Did you have any pushback from anybody? Were there anything that people felt that you hadn't captured accurately in your research?
Oh, you know, there were like some people can be sort of strange about the way that you've described their face, or there were some things that the police wanted changed, but nothing dramatic. So the lawyers all read through, the police all read through, Brendan's family read through, a woman who I interview in the book who lost children, she'd read through. And, you know, that was an achievement, kind of getting to the point where everybody actually was happy with what was there. You know, I'm writing something now where I really don't have to seek permission from, you know, two people, and that's it. And that's a huge relief.
What about the character of Brendan himself?
Yes.
I mean, he's obviously the central character in the book. He's the convicted arsonist, and you spend a lot of time exploring his background and his psychology.
Yeah.
But as you make clear in the coda, you weren't able to interview him despite your attempts to do so.
Yeah.
Which you actually describe in the book as something you were both disappointed and relieved by.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about your thinking around that and how, you know, the absence of Brendan's voice kind of shaped your thinking?
Brendan's family and Brendan gave permission for his lawyers to speak to me. And yet when later I wrote to Brendan asking to see him, he had forgotten about or didn't understand that a book was being written. He has issues with his memory. His supervisor at the prison basically just told him, you know, don't write back. So I guess I don't actually feel that his voice isn't there, because actually throughout the book, police interviews, I mean, I guess another sort of, you know, archival instance are all there. So you do hear, you know, his voice. And then, you know, there's a letter included that he's written. So there are sort of other ways. And I guess there are also witnesses who told their stories, including what Brendan had told them. Well, I mean, I guess this is, you know, again, the archive versus the real person. Mm. And until you've actually sort of sat opposite somebody and seen the way they hold themselves or how they respond to your questions or don't respond, you know, it's really difficult to get as intimate a portrait as a writer would like.
Yeah. It is amazing, though, I think, that given that you didn't meet Brendan, how much he comes to life and all the characters comes to life on the page. I mean, to me, the book really reads like a novel in many ways, you know, and there are structural reasons for that, obviously. Yeah. A lot of it's written in the present tense. There's dialogue. There's a kind of omniscient narrator. And I was really struck by the kind of level of sensory detail. Like we're given a lot of information about what people are looking at, the way they walk, things like that. How did you get at those kind of novelistic details?
By driving my sort of, you know, interview subjects really nuts. You know, there might have been one small detail in an interview which sort of opened up, I guess, a novelistic scene for me, and then I would, you know, just harass them for what other things they remembered about that to bring it to life, because it was a difficult story to actually make rise off the page, and those were the things I needed. As it is when you're looking at an archive and you find that whatever details swim out and have a sense of life to them, maybe years and years later, a lot of this information can be so dry and it's really hard to find those nuggets. And it's a bit like an interview process, you know, actually finally an interview might seem to go badly and then there might just be one story that someone tells you which gives you a window into something more personal or emotional or telling. So that's what I'm always trying to ferret out.
Chloe, we all approach the archive, any archive, whether it's an archive in process like a courtroom or a collection of letters that's 200 years old, we approach it with from a subject position. The archive's not neutral, and neither are we. I'm really interested in how you felt your subject position might have changed between writing The Tall Man and The Arsonist. How did you change as a researcher over that time?
Ooh, I mean, I'm kind of an ad hoc researcher because, I mean, it's not necessarily my bread and butter, and my poor methods are probably just the same as they always were, just sort of go in and try and get as much as you can.
But if you were to write The Tall Man again today, would you be asking different questions or searching for different evidence or chasing down different leads?
Yes, I would.
So how does your subject position change then?
As you do more of this kind of work, you become more confident and have a better sense of where the fault lines are of a story are, and, you know, where you need to press harder and who you really need to pursue.
This is something that fascinated me reading the book. One of the most noticeable differences between The Tall Man and The Arsonist is your decision not to write yourself into The Arsonist. As a character, you know, you're not the researcher or the narrator even. What informed that decision?
Well, The Tall Man, I was sort of on the ground while events were happening. The legal proceedings were playing out while I was in the courtroom or while I was in the inquest hearing, whereas with this book, I had come to it years later. It's all a recreation, you know, other than the coda at the end where I appear.
Did it make it easier or harder to write?
I think first person, there are a lot of things that you can kind of do when the action on stage is, you know, dull. You know, suddenly you can sort of bring in a memory, or, I mean, you know, you can see it when you're reading first person, what tricks the writer's using. It didn't feel appropriate to use first person in this book from this distance to arrive in a first person lady writer detective persona, and the police and the lawyer's perspective was the right distance, I thought, to tell the broader story of trauma and environmental catastrophe.
So did you have any qualms about inserting yourself in the story in The Tall Man when, even though you're involved in the story as it's playing out in real time, you're still the kind of, you know, educated white woman from down south coming up to engage in the lives of this Aboriginal community on Palm Island?
I don't think I sort of, you know, pretend to be anything other than that, the outsider, you know, right from the beginning of that book. If I were to write it now, maybe it would be different. But I imagine that there's an immediacy that a first person can capture if you're actually there, which I think it would be a little bit false to actually not declare your position.
And of course, someone else who is well known for writing these kind of first person accounts of criminal investigations and trials is Helen Garner. And I know you've said elsewhere that you're a big admirer of her work. Do you think you've been influenced by her kind of ways of researching and writing? And, you know, are there other people you sort of see as guides in this mode of research?
Well, I don't really know what research Helen does. We haven't spoken about that. I would say that a difference between our work is actually that I'm very interested in what a crime tells you sociologically. And I'm not sure if Helen would necessarily, if that would be the kind of starting point necessarily for Helen. With this last book, The Arsonist, I knew that it was going to be interesting psychologically because I mean it's such strange behavior, deliberately setting a fire, but also that it would tell me a story about global warming and the environment, and, you know, that the figure of the arsonist maybe is a Trojan horse in a way to actually talk about these other things.
That sociological aspect of the arsonist is a really strong component of it, and I really loved learning about the Latrobe Valley from the book. And really that charred landscape of the Latrobe Valley is like a character in itself. And the coda of the book describes you driving around that area. So it feels like you're kind of engaging in the physical archive in that sense. Did visiting Churchill and surrounding areas give you a new level of understanding that you wouldn't have gotten from the written sources?
Of course, but also, you know, what would the written sources have been? Because there are a couple of good books about the Latrobe Valley, but there aren't an enormous number of them. I mean, there's something about actually seeing the size of a hole in the ground that's as big as Melbourne's CBD and actually seeing the emissions coming out of a power station that's the dirtiest in the OECD that's going to give you a really visceral sense of a place that's, you know, hard to find probably in archival material.
Yeah, it just strikes me again, that's another difference between, say, a novelist's eye and an academic researcher because, you know, say, for example, I've just written a book based on archives about the London suffragettes, but I didn't visit London and the places where they held these rallies and these demonstrations. And possibly if I did, would have had a much greater sense of place and the way that place shaped story.
Why did you not do that?
I didn't have the time or the resources to do it. And I think that because there is a great gulf of time as well, I mean, I'm writing about something that happened a century ago, possibly it doesn't feel as immediate or as necessary to do. And yet immersing yourself in the physical archive might have changed the questions that I asked of the documentary archive. So I just am interested in the different ways in which, say, a novelist's brain and an historian's brain might work.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think that made me think about place in a different way. Actually, it made me think of the substrata up. You know, this community is based on or built around rock or coal that's volatile and ready to burn, could instantly combust as it's brought out of the ground. And that, you know, that did make me think about the actual rock we're on right now. I do think it does have its own power and weight.
So you did go and get your boots dirty as a researcher, as the historian Keith Hancock would say. Thank you to Chloe Hooper for coming in to chat to us today. So until next time, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright. And you've been listening to Archive Fever,
a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on Wurundjeri land. Wurundjeri sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
You can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Reese.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
Coming up on the next episode...
I think the courage of Aboriginal people, particularly a lot of women are doing this research, they wouldn't separate their emotional response from the intellectual response, and they will really front people about that and saying, yeah, we're not going to separate our emotional intelligence from our intellectual intelligence.